Frontline Season 2 is the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of everyday people. Join us as we dive into the lives of frontline workers who make a difference in their communities. In this unique series, our dedicated guests document their daily experiences from Monday to Friday, offering an intimate glimpse into the challenges and triumphs they face on the front lines. And welcome to episode 3 of season 2, A Week in the Life Of. I am David Gill.
And I'm Andrew James.
And in this episode, we have a psychologically informed environment lead coming on to talk about his week. So how has the last couple of weeks been for you, Andy? Been up to much?
Busy doing a few bits. Work-wise, but also on a personal note, a little bit of celebrations because Liverpool won the Carabao Cup. Thank you very much for asking, David. Thank you. Really appreciate that. Yes, I had a very good time.
I was going to ask that question thinking deep down, how soon can he say it? Or is he going to try and be really professional and say other things? But yes, you've got it in.
Oh, yeah, immediately. I see no point holding back.
No. Good performance by the kids there against the billion-dollar Chelsea, as they call them.
Well, I don't want to delve too much into this. I'm sure our listeners don't want this to devolve into a football podcast. But, yes, I was very pleased with a paper-thin team getting over the line. And I think I'll leave it at that because I can talk about this for days.
Brilliant stuff. Well, I have been working on something a bit exciting as well that hopefully our listeners can share. So as people might already know, we have the trauma-informed learning tool that we run, and we've been working on something that we are hopefully going to launch in a few weeks' time as well, which is going to be something called the Tilt Community, where we're creating almost like a safe space, a social media style element of the platform for people to go on, share good practice, learn about things, have top conversations with people from different parts of the country working in different types of services. It's going to be a completely free resource for people to make the most of. And we're going to try and run a few sort of meetups and maybe some live podcast recordings in the future on there as well. So we'll see how we get on. So if you're interested in that, keep your eyes out, and we'll launch it on social media in a few weeks. So let's start with psychologically informed. It's an interesting sort of title. It's an interesting sort of concept then. What's your thoughts, Andrew, and what that means? What's your interpretation of it?
My interpretation of that is really is when it's psychologically informed, you're stripping everything away. I think it just, to me, speaks to more of a human-focused and human-centered sort of approach, taking into account, you know, someone's emotions, thoughts, feelings, and, you know, it being holistic in that sense. That would be my interpretation.
Yeah. I guess it's one of those things that, in an ideal world, we wouldn't really need to be thinking about. It's just, you know, what every service has built into it. But I guess the main challenge with it is the systems around us, you know, the systems that don't always allow us to take into account the people we're in front of and to give them the best experience we can because of budgets or lack of, and, you know, like just in terms of like how services are commissioned and policies as well. So it's a difficult one, I'm sure, and it's one that it's about striking up a balance. So that brings us nicely to Anthony Vaughan, who's our guest this episode, who's the head of PIE Operations and Therapeutic Services. And welcome to this week's guest. We have Anthony Vaughan with us, who For people who've been listening from the very beginning, may remember him from our very, very, very first episode. So, was it about 18 months ago now? So, all this time, we didn't scare him off, and he has come back to talk about his week that he recorded for us. So, firstly, Anthony, welcome back. Thank you for being our guest again.
Thank you for having me. I'm very pleased to be back. Yeah.
So, for our listeners who may not know who you are, may not have heard the previous episode, do you just want to give us an overview of the job that you do, your job title, your experience, anything like that?
Yeah, I am the head of Pie Operations and Therapeutic Services for the Warwich, which I know is a very grand title. I'm not particularly keen on the length of it, but yeah, I am. The Warwich, we are the largest homeless charity in Wales. We've got, we're in 20 of the 20 local authorities. We've got about 100 odd services across the whole of Wales. About, I think it's about 530 staff at the last count. So, you know, we're the largest homeless charity in Wales. And I am the person that is trying to help us achieve our fifth strategic priority in our business plan, which is set out under our value of compassion, and that is to become a truly psychologically informed organization. So that's my role, and that's a big part of it. And then I also oversee the therapeutic services, which consist of some engagement well-being mentors who provide a lot of activities in North, Mid, and Southeast Wales. I've got asset coaches following the using the strength-based approach again, North, Southwest, Southeast, and Swansea. And then I also oversee somebody, Steve, who manages the Reflections Network, which is a ne network of counsellors across Wales, independent counsellors who provide counselling to our service users. So yeah, I've been in the organisation. I've just had my 16th anniversary, believe it or not, in January. I started as a frontline worker at a project for what, you know, 24-hour project. We used to do 24-hour shifts, going at 3. Work till 11, sleep in, get up the next day. And it was a project that still exists actually in Aberystwyth, but it was for when it started, priority prolific offenders, which don't sort of aren't in the term used anymore, isn't it? And prison leavers. And there's the sort of the current version of that still exists in Aberystwyth. So that's how I started. And then I did that for about 6 years, and I ended up managing all the projects in Ceredigion for 6 years before starting this role in, well, my last working day in Aberystwyth was March the 20th, 2020, and I was due to move to Cardiff on March the 30th, 2020. And you can figure out how exactly that went. It took me a while to get there eventually, but yeah, that's me. That's where I am at the moment. So yeah.
Fantastic. And I think it's important you clarify that, because when you hear the word pie in a job title, it's people who don't know that terminology and that word, you could be thinking, what are we talking, meat pies, apple
Yes.
pies?
Yeah.
So yeah, so it's a bit of clarification there.
Yeah, it struck me when I was re-listening back to the reflection that I didn't actually mention PI or psychological environments at all during my reflection, which kind of goes to show how broad and holistic it is, and that it sort of covers a lot of everything, which you can sort of see from my week really. So yeah.
Brilliant. So, without further ado, let's listen to your week in reflection.
Well, to start with, David, I think I probably need to apologise because, as is often the case with me, I didn't really plan or prepare any of this in advance. So, unfortunately, I didn't record every day. I'm doing an end of week wrap up, which I think was probably not what I intended at the start of the week, but unfortunately, that's how it's fallen. But it was a good week, I think, for me to do this because it kind of shows the variety and the different things that I'm doing in this sort of role. So I started the week by visiting. I was in Aberystwyth for something I'll talk about in a second. So on Monday I went back and visited and spent some time with the staff in our services in the projects in Aberystwyth. They are the services that I used to manage for many years. I worked in for many years, 6 years as a frontline worker, and then I managed them for 6 years before moving on into this role. So it's really good to go and spend some time down there with Kenny and Nikki and Jules and Demo and some of the staff in there. There's a much bigger staff team than I used to manage now. You know, it's interesting to see a lot of the changes that have happened there. It's really interesting for me, as you might imagine. Some of the things that struck me were that they are still working there in the services with some of the people that have been around for years that I used to work with and were in the services when I managed, but also they're working with a much larger cohort, particularly rough sleepers. The rough sleeping has really picked up in and around Aberystwyth. But what struck me is what often strikes me, particularly the last couple of years, is how complex the cohort they work in are. Things are more difficult there than I think they have ever been, and it's the same, in pretty much all of our services, and I'm sure people listening to this recognise what I'm saying. Service users are more complex, more stretched, and there's less options for them to move on. And that really struck me when I was in Aberystwyth talking about some of the people that they're working with, and particularly people that I've known in those services for years, and the sort of situations they progressed to. That was quite, not shocking, I suppose, but it's just interesting to see that from the perspective of people that I know and know well. Yeah, that was quite interesting. But again, it was good to spend time with Kenny and the team and to see the plans they've got to finally renovate the small little downstairs office that I've had for years and take over the building upstairs now that there's been some move on from people in there and turn it back into offices. That was good to see for me. And then Tuesday was the reason that I was in Aberystwyth. Myself, Kenny, Nikki and Jules, and a couple of colleagues from the NHS, Donna, who was the advanced hepatology practitioner, and Rhiann, who is the alcohol liaison nurse, we did a 2-hour lecture, as it was called, to the first year nursing degree students in Aberystwyth. And I titled it Health and Homelessness, How We Can Do Better. And it was sort of talking to those as first year nursing degree students, people who were coming into the NHS, about homelessness in general, the fact that trauma is prevalent amongst the homeless population and what that means for people, in regards to the trauma reactions and coping mechanisms and how that presents to people, in their day-to-day lives, how that affects them and how that can result in behaviour that challenges us and the services that these nurses are going to be working in. We sort of focused on that a little bit, and then I got sort of spoke about the work that we do at the Warwich, and I got Nikki and Jules up to talk about how they build relationships with our service users and what sort of health challenges they face. Then we sort of talked from there about the poor health outcomes that homeless people experience from, just the fact that being homeless isn't in and of itself is a health issue, and when you add in other types of disadvantage, like sort of say opioid dependence or mental health or psychosis, how your health outcomes get worse and worse as these different disadvantages come in, and the early life expectancy of people who are homeless, all the different worsening health outcomes for diseases that shouldn't be. We focused on that, why that might be, what some of the barriers are to service users that we work with accessing the health services. And then we brought Rhiann and Donna up, as colleagues in the NHS who've worked for many years and done some incredible work with our service users. We brought them up to sort of talk about how they work with people, how they challenge stigma, that they, the stigma that our service users face and the people they work with face, how they challenge that. And, sort of said to them what piece of advice would they give for their colleagues coming into the NHS. And Donna said, just, to just treat people like a human being. Just, uh, just, you know, if you or your family member were in that situation, how would you want to be treated? She said. So, you know, it was really, really good day. We ended off then by sort of doing a sort of best practice example of a service that we have in Swansea and Neath Port Talbot, the 360 Helping End Homeless project in Swansea, which has a sort of lottery funded project that has an occupational therapist embedded within it, and you know, several different partner delivery agencies, including the Warwich and Crisis and Barod, and how they are getting good outcomes for service users they're working with, and you know, including the fact of them not having to retell their story, which is a big part of one of the barriers that service users can face. And then we ended off with a bit of an ask of the nurses what we'd like them to do as they come in, you know, things like following nice guidelines around working with homeless individuals, you know, joining up to the Queen's Nursing Institute and lots of other different things. And then we had a sort of question and answer, which was very lively. They had to they had to throw us out of the lecture theatre at the end because we were getting so many questions. So yeah, it was really good day, really, really enjoyed it. Very very enthused to see the feedback we were getting from people coming into the NHS, and again to be reminded of, you know, the good work that we do with, you know, many colleagues in the NHS. You know, it's a good, I haven't seen Donna for some time, so it was really good to see her and see the, and talk about the work that they do. I took a pause for a moment there. So yeah, that was Tuesday. Wednesday, I spent at the office in Swansea. Spent time there meeting up with colleagues and just catching up. But also the purpose of me being there was we had one of our substance use task force meetings. So we're currently in process within the organisation of just rewriting our drug use policies and procedures to just, you know, to try and sort of bring them in line, make them a little bit more trauma informed, to simplify them a little bit, because we had several different procedures that sort of all fed into one another. So yeah, we've done much of the work. We've created a document that we will, you know, fairly simple four pager that staff will show to service users as they come into the service, called Drug Use at the Warwich, What You Need to Know. And it sort of talks about, these are the things that we will do for you, these are the things that we must do to work in line with our police protocol, the agreement that we've got from police on the ways that we will work. And then we sort of wrote the procedure for staff to work in line with that. This is the stuff that we're talking to service users about, so this is how you will do that, you know, step by step as a staff member, if you like. We thought we kind of had it finished, but then we sort of needed to come back together just to finalise some pieces of work around, you know, exactly what to do with any drugs that you might find in the service, you know, like not so unaccompanied drugs in the communal area, like what exactly is the step-by-step process that staff would take. Not that we didn't have that written down before, but again, we're trying to sort of simplify it, make it a little bit more easy to understand. And we're also writing in there explicitly that in an ideal world, any substances that are found, we would like them to be first, our first preference is for those to be sent to Wedonos, the drug testing service that we've got in Wales, but actually, you know, we accept samples from all over the UK. That's our sort of preference, really. That's what we would like them to do. So that was a big part of the substance abuse meeting yesterday, and I took on the task of, I suppose, writing that procedure. And then the other part of the day in Swansea was I met up with Sharon, who is my PI services manager, who works underneath me, and she a lot of her role is focused on reflective practice. So we had a one-to-one together. We were just catching up and seeing how things are going. And she's currently writing a sort of training delivery of reflective practice, how she delivers reflective practice, so we can try and get managers and teams to sort of do a little bit more of it themselves without Sharon necessarily coming and doing sessions all the time. So we were focusing on that, and as as often happens when you talk to somebody about reflective practices, about 10 different ways of looking at things at least, isn't there? So we went back and forth about how she will describe the work that she does and the sort of framework that she uses, and you know, reflecting on the trauma-informed principles that we're trying to embed within the organisation was a part of that. So yeah, we had a good one-to-one yesterday. Thursday was a pretty simple sort of admin day, really, trying to catch up on pieces of work, going through my emails. The other staff member that I oversee, Steve, is on leave at the moment, and he oversees a network of independent counsellors. We call it the Reflections Network. So they provide counselling to our service users. So you know, we manage the waiting lists and, you know, take in their spreadsheets at the end of the month so we can upload the data on Inform and their invoices and stuff. And yeah, because Steve is on leave, I much of my day on Thursday was dealing with the sort of end of month data coming through from the Reflections Network counsellors, and, you know, then telling me they'd ended sessions with some person and picking up people on the waiting list and sort of communicating back and forth with them. So that was a big part of my day on Thursday, which is something I don't do very often, like I say, because Steve normally oversees all that stuff, but as he's on leave, it's fallen to me at the moment. And then today, again, another bit of an admin day, but also this morning I attended the Camorth Cymru Third Sector Substance Use Network meeting, and Camorth Cymru are our sort of sector body in Wales, if you like. They're like our Homeless Link version of Homeless Link in Wales, if you like. They advocate and you know, campaign on our behalf. They're doing some excellent campaigning at the moment to ensure the housing support grant budget at least remained the same. The housing support grant allocation has remained the same in our draft budget this year and not been cut. So yeah, it was a really good meeting with the third sector. Lots of people in there, people from Welsh Government, substance use leads from Welsh Government talking about that. Somebody on there talking about the upcoming evaluation of the Buvidal rollout in Wales and how that's going to be evaluated. And a big chunk of the meeting was taken up by the worrying increase of nitazenes, I'm not quite sure how you say it, but the synthetic opioid that's been creeping into the UK drug supply. There have been a spate of deaths in Cardiff just around Christmas time, and I believe since, where nitazene has been detected and the early forensics at the scene. So it was the meeting, we were focusing on that quite a lot, and how also the nitazenes are being found in benzodiazepines and Xanax, and most of the testing on Wedinos, I think half of it is in heroin samples, half of it is in benzo samples, which is interesting in and of itself, I suppose. And yeah, we focused on that quite a bit. We were talking about, we as an organisation, we've always encouraged the use of naloxone. We were saying, we are pushing all staff in the organisation, whether it's in a residential project, frontline out in the community, backroom office, everybody to sort of carry naloxone. It's a very worrying time when you think about the synthetic opioids sneaking into the drug supply, and can't see it doing anything but getting worse, really. So yeah, that was this morning. It is Friday today, I'm recording this for you. So yeah, that was this morning. And then this afternoon I again caught up with a bit more admin. I wrote that that procedure that I just mentioned for the, the finding substances procedure for the policy. I could finish that this morning, sent it back to the group to take their comments on. And it's now coming up to 4:30, 4:45 on the Friday, and I'm thinking of just sending a few more emails and signing off for the weekend.
Okay, so that was your week. So let's just think about that week and delve a little bit deeper into it. So Andrew, up to you then. Sort of any sort of reflections or questions from that week for Anthony?
Yeah, just a couple of questions, Anthony, really. The first thing that jumped out to me is you were talking about there's been a rise in the complex needs in the service user cohort that you're working with at the minute. And there's also a mention at one point about you looking into simplify and streamline policies and procedures. Would you say there's a correlation, or do you think it would be too reductive to say that you have that the more complex the needs of the cohort, the more streamlined and straightforward an approach you need to take?
I think there is a correlation. I don't think I was necessary or we are necessarily looking at it in those terms. But I think, when we are talking about when you were talking about the streamlining stuff, you were talking about the substance use work that I was talking about there, wasn't it? So what, like, on that working group are a couple of managers from probably from our biggest sort of frontline hospitals, if you like, sort of thing. The stuff that I've been developing, they're taking back and putting on the front line and trying it, so for them, particularly when we were talking about the flow charts and all that sort of stuff, it was very much, when you've got a big policy of 15 pages sort of thing, and it's something's kicking off on the front line, you need to know, right, what do I do to, I don't know, help? It's a night worker who's not been there long, and I need to sort of understand what's the best way of dealing with an overdose, say, for example. It's a bit of an extreme example, but so, that's what we mean there by, just giving somebody a very quick, simple flow chart sort of thing, do this, do this, do this type thing. So yeah, I think it wasn't specifically our thinking, but I guess for me, that's all I've ever really tried to do with my role, I suppose, is, I was a frontline worker, I was a frontline manager, and the worlds of PIE and being trauma informed and stuff, particularly when you use that word terminology, psychologically informed, can seem very sort of aspirational and theoretical, can't it? They sort of seem up here. And all I've ever really tried to do in my role is to sort of bring those worlds together, really, isn't it? Make it as functional, as applicable as possible for people who are working on the front line, people who are, who we ask a lot of, who are not paid particularly well, depending on general service in the sector. So yeah, I've always tried to sort of, that's what I've been trying to do, really, with that sort of stuff. But yeah, and in regards to the complex needs, that's more, I mean, you guys, I'm sure, have come across it. It's just whether or not it's actually the case, or whether or not it feels like it's the case. Everywhere we go, it seems like clients are more complex, services are more stretched, and that seems to be across the board for us, really. So yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Another question on policies and procedures. I think this works well flowing on because you mentioned yourself then a policy off the top of your head of overdose, for example. I talked about the policy of having a naloxone on site, which always a good policy to have. It genuinely does save lives, so it needs to be there. Given that obviously, that's quite a safety-focused approach. Given the prohibition remains the sort of prevalent government policy, has there been any sort of kickback or any barriers that you've faced in kind of getting that out to staff? And if so, what have you kind of done to try to overcome that?
Not really. I mean, we've always been, as long as I can remember, we've been an organization that is harm reduction focused. Going back to when I started, the hospital, the one the manager I was talking about, this oversees the hospital in Cardiff. I've been in the organization 16 years. That's always had needle exchange within that hospital, and there's been an understanding, of how people work and looking to reduce people's harm as much as possible. So it is something we have always done. I have spoken to some staff who were occasionally a little bit twitchy about, particularly with the pranoxide, the needles side of it, but for me, now that you can kind of get the Nyxoid pebbles and sprays and all that sort of stuff in most places, I don't think there's really a reason to be squeamish about it. Like you say, all that does is save lives, really. So as with everything, not everything necessarily, but as with a lot of things in our sector, we're given the grey, don't we? So there's a lot of nuance in how you do this stuff, and even for an organisation, I guess we have sort of services that are, we class them as high tolerance, where we can accept people using substances on the premises. Then we've got unspecified ones where, depending on the local authority, that may be the case, that may not be the case. Then we've obviously got ones, abstinence-based projects and other projects where that we cannot allow substance use on the premises. Allow is the wrong word. We can understand or tolerate it happening. But again, we do those, we do that in line with the with an agreement that we've got with the police. And you know, there are certain aspects of it, like as we all know, Misuse of Drugs Act is over 50 years old. So the one thing we cannot allow and have to take a zero tolerance approach to is cannabis smoking on the premises. So, and you know, it's just one of those sort of strange nuances, isn't it, that you have to sort of work around. So I don't think we get much kickback there. You know, to say with that, I obviously haven't spoken to every service, technical service unit, sorry, every staff member. And the policy, I'll be honest with you, the policy is still, we just yesterday, in fact, we had we the substance use supergroup team, as our director of ops calls us, we took it to our, you know, all of our senior leaders, showed them what we've done, as in reducing five policies down to one, the new flowcharts, the very clear communication for service users, and linking that to how we work with them. And you know, we're just waiting for the sign off from them. So we haven't actually pushed it out to the organization as yet, but it's built on what we had before, if you know what I mean. So I don't envisage there being too much of an issue. In fact, I envisage there being people being pleased with it, because it's much clearer, much simpler, much less things to look at and documents to go through, really. So yeah.
Okay. Going, looking back at your reflections, you talk about on the Tuesday, you were at the lecture with your colleagues, Nicky and Jules, and you were eventually ushered off the stage of the lecture due to
We
the
were,
four
yes.
questions that you were being asked. Are there any questions that you can recall that you didn't mention on the reflections that kind of stood out to you or challenged you the
You
most?
know what? I can't really think now. My memory's terrible. What questions are we getting? I mean, there was a it was quite a lot of stuff around mental health, if I'm honest with you, because there was about 80 people in that lecture, about 80 nurses, and you know, from a range of ages. And I think a lot of the questions we were getting back and forth were sort of questions around mental health and how that is very, you know, problematic for us, for the sector at large, really trying to get mental health support. You know, we did a survey on our staff. Like I said, we're the largest homeless charity in Wales. We did a survey on our staff, which we launched last year, called Mental Health on Hold. We met when we launched the report, and you know, our staff said that within the last 12 months, 96% of them had supported a service user in mental health crisis. Of those who replied, I think it was I can't remember the exact stats. It was around 70% said help was incredibly difficult to get, and then there was another sort of 15% who said it did not exist, sort of thing. You know, so that's more than 85% of our staff, the largest homeless charity in Wales, saying support for service users in mental health crisis either doesn't exist or is very difficult to get hold of. So you know, there was a lot of questions around that, and I think there was, you know, there's quite a few questions around the sort of barrier aspect, I suppose, as well. And you know, I mentioned my colleagues from the NHS, Donna and Rhian, and Donna's so good at sort of standing there and talking to, you know, she's been a nurse practitioner for years, and she's talking to these people coming in the NHS about like addressing stigmas that the people you face, you know, and how to just treat people like a human being. That, you know, that was some of the really good stuff. Funnily enough, we did a second session last week, actually, to the to it was only about 11 people in that session, same session, but they were healthcare support workers who've been working in the NHS for a while, and you know, they can sort of get the degree through doing that. So we did a second session in Aberystwyth just last week, and there was, yeah, there was similar questions again, and but there was also, so we tended, for some reason, that one veered off into a lot of substance use stuff again. So you know, which the other one didn't, and we ended up talking a bit around that and the, you know, the nitazene stuff, and yeah, it was interesting. I wish I could remember more questions. Sorry, Andrew, I should have thought and had to think about that.
It's quite all right, yeah. It's when you're working, it's so many things, so many places. That's one of the things I noticed with your reflections, you know. Aberystwyth and Swansea, you know, they're not exactly nearby, it's about 70, 75 miles between them, so
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, I do. It always strikes me when I do those sort of things that we, you know, we talk about the prevalence of trauma amongst the sort of chronically homeless population, that, well, the chronically homeless group of people that we work with, or and you know, the stuff that really stands out to me, you know, this things like the life expectancy of somebody who is homeless, and you can sort of it's shocking to people when they see it. And you know, you and I always we create a little video, and I sort of say to people at the end of anything, they stand out there, and most people will jump on that first of all, which is what I want them to do. And I always sort of say, you know, like that's for me, that's the thing that stands out when you think, you know, you're talking about a population of people there in one of the wealthiest countries in the world who are dying that early for something that's entirely avoidable. And it's entire, you know, it's scandalous, isn't it? We stopped homelessness in COVID when, you know, when we wanted to. You know, and I got to, you know, it's when you see those sort of light bulbs going off on people and sort of beginning to understand the disadvantages that somebody's homeless faces, it's really satisfying to me to sort of see that stuff happening and people beginning to think a little bit differently. Yeah, it's good.
Excellent. And then I'll just one last quick question just before I hand over to see if David's got any last bits to ask. In terms of your particular charity, have you noticed this is following on from our last guest, Richie Andrew, who was on last week, or last time, I should say. Have you noticed any changes in attrition rates for your service users? And if so, have you done anything to try and combat that?
How do you mean by attrition rates? As in people staying in services or staying with services? I don't. I'll be honest with you. It's not something I have looked into or would know. But I would. I mean, I think what we're finding, particularly in our residential services, is that people are there for longer, much longer. You know, we had in Wales last December the Rent in Homes Wales Act came into effect, and I don't know if you know what that is or what it means, but essentially it has meant that people in services on license agreements depend, again this is looked at slightly differently with different local authorities, but as of December last year a cohort of people on turned from license agreements immediately into standard contracts, they call it. So what used to be an AST, so they are there with the assurance, you know, in shared living hostels with the assurance of, you know, as what used to be a short-term tenancy sort of thing, you know. So we and the move-on options have begun, as I'm sure you're aware, are becoming more and more limited for people. So particularly in residential services, I think we've got people for probably even longer than we used to have them. In regards to, I mean, actually, I do know you were saying about attrition rates. I do know one sort of service that I could tell you that about is our network. You know, I was talking about the Reflection Network for Counsellors. That the attrition rate of that tends to be around about 65% to 70% attendance rate, which I think is, I'm still pretty pleased with that sort of thing. And we are always trying to improve that. But when we sort of when we do a bit of scrutiny on the people that aren't completing, it tends to be people who perhaps might not necessarily be prepared for counselling. So we, you know, like Steve's done a sort of prep for therapy course sessions that he's rolling out with staff to try and get people in the areas in particular where we've got bigger waiting lists to bring some of the people who might be coming up in and sort of prepare them for what therapy might be like and giving them some grounding techniques and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, we do, that is something we do. But in regards to all of the services, I couldn't really tell you. But yeah.
Well, that's fair enough. And to be fair, for the counselling, 60 to 70% attendance rates, that's really good. So I think
Yeah.
that's definitely something you should be proud of.
But that's, you know, we when we talk about it, we highlight that as being, you know, it's an addition for our service users, isn't it? So a service user to access it has to be in one of our core services. So we have that communication with the key worker to say this appointment's coming up. Can you make sure they're reminded? Can you even support, not that they would go to the session with them, but can you support them to it? And then the counselor's got that community point of contact between. So we, you know, we think that's something that really works well with the service.
Fantastic. Okay. That's my questions. Thank you, Andy. David, how about you?
Yeah, so I just want to pick up on something that I think it was on Monday, and you kind of touched upon it a little bit there as well, is about complex needs, how there's a rise of complex needs, you know, there's a reduction in services. What I really want to ask is around this term complex needs, because I guess it can be quite subjective, because that's the reality of the terminology. Complex means there's going to be so many involved. But what is there any sort of themes that you've seen as that what's kind of been behind the push in complexity and the numbers rising? You know, is there any sort of like ongoing themes about it, or is it just that's the challenge, there isn't any themes?
I don't don't think there is any particular themes. You just when you were saying complex needs there, made me, you know, we try to use, we tend to try not to use the sort of, because it's kind of able in terms, and then we try to try and in the organization, we try to say multiple disadvantage rather than complex needs as much as we can, sort of thing. You know, we're always looking at our language, and when I was talking about it with the nurses, it's something I sort of put up on there. But in regards to what you're saying, David, I don't think there's any theme other than, you know, that there are fewer and fewer places, I think, for people to get support. You know, yeah, mental health is. Support for mental health is always a has always been a theme in the sector, I think, or something that gets discussed a lot. And I think, you know, it's to this day it still is. So that if you want to talk about a theme, I suppose that is one. But I've sort of come around to a different way of thinking on that over the last few years in regards to, you know, mental health services are set up under the medical model, aren't they? So they're meant to clinically diagnose a condition and medicate it, whereby most of our service uses the condition is trauma. And so, you know, does that necessarily exist in the mental health services, or does that exist widespread? You know, a sort of long term, possibly never ending talking therapy, I guess, is what you need for that. And I don't think it really there's many services that can offer that within the mental. So I think that's part of it. And like I say, it's just I think it's the lack of, you know, the lack of movement opportunities, you know, just the accommodation stuff. You know, I'm sure it's the same wherever you talk to staff that you know, COVID sort of really brought this into focus, didn't it? But the sort of the rents are going up and up and up. And, you know, like we have local housing allowance, don't we? You know, and this that's set on the 30th lowest 30th percentile in an area. So the realistically how somebody can go from one of our services into their own accommodation. And, you know, council housing, housing association properties, there's less and less of that. So I think it's people just being within services for longer for us as well is probably a theme. And again, I guess the you know, the sort of the substance use stuff, isn't it? We've, you know, I spoke about it in there, you know, we've seen it, you know, when I first started, a lot of people used to use Valium, but you know, I'm talking 16 years ago, and that was probably Valium you get through the GP, whereby now they're all using street benzos, aren't they? Like flubramazine, bromazepam, whatever it might be that you see tested as, then I think some of that it's causing difficulty as well. Just, you know, everything seems to be getting a little bit more complicated, I guess, in that regard.
It's again, I think the fact that you highlighted it's the complex needs are going up, the services have reduced. I think it's easy to assume, and it's probably the most likely conclusion here is that the more you reduce services, the less that you are to be proactive with your responses. And instead, what we tend to see now with a lot of services, whatever they're commissioned to be, they tend to be so unbelievably reactive because you get people at desperation point, as you say, about things like the cost of living. It's changed astronomically in the last 5 years. And you also mentioned about the drugs trends as well. So again, I know we talked about the naloxone and responding to the heightened synthetic opioids. I guess one of the debates at the minute around all of that is of increasing testing and exploring, I guess, more, should we say, forward thinking harm reduction strategies like the safe consumption rooms up in Glasgow and hopefully Edinburgh as well. Do you think there's any scope for that within services, or at least within some of the services you work alongside, maybe not directly work?
Well, I mean, testing wise, we've had the Wednos site in Wales for some time, and like you know, I mentioned it in there. But our now we have written it into the policy procedure. Our organizational directive is any substances that are found within a service, we want them to be sent to Wednos. And you do that in what we've said is, if you find substances, ring the police, tell them we're going to send them to Wednos, and yes, they want them to do something different with it. You know, and so if they want you to do something different, as in they want to come and collect it, then do so. But otherwise, within 72 hours, send it to Wednos. So that's what we are saying is happening. And then, sorry, David, I lost my train of thought there. What was the second part of your question?
It was just about the how more
Yeah,
forward
the safer
thinking harm
consumption
reduction.
rooms and stuff, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, our chief exec is very much, you know, on board with the idea. You know, but it seems to make sense, doesn't it? But also, we are, even though we are, you know, we work in Wales and live in Wales, we're still overseen by Westminster, aren't we? So, you
Mm.
know, like we have a devolved government over certain aspects, but that's one of those aspects that you're never similar in Swansea. I think that's Swansea, Swansea. Similar in Scotland is in regards to, you know, the stuff that they're opening there. I think if Westminster wanted to really stop it, they probably could, sort of thing. You know what I mean? So I think they would. I think there is an appetite for it. I talked in the thing tonight about sitting on the third sector substance use network, and I, you know,
Yeah.
from being on that, there's very much an appetite for doing things differently and trying different things. You know, I'm very much in favor of what what's the gentleman's name? Danny Ahmed did up in Middlesbrough, isn't it? You know, the heroin assistant treatment
Yeah.
program, giving people actual heroin rather than methadone, buprenorphine, and all that sort of stuff. But again, that's the funding for that has gone, isn't it? So, you know, I think we would love to take a progressive approach to all of this sort of stuff. And I think where we can, we will. But it's, you know, it's doing so within the law, I suppose, isn't it? And what we're allowed to do as well. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely. That was the main reason I asked, because Scotland have shown that even though the drug laws aren't devolved, they're kind of far enough away that they can kind of maybe get away with being a little bit more dynamic. And a cynic may even say that if it goes wrong, the Westminster government could say, well, we knew this was going to go wrong. But if
Yeah,
it goes
exactly.
right where we think it will be right, they can say, well, actually, we really wanted to do this, and now we've seen a good example of it, and we'll go ahead with it. So
Yeah, I mean, I really respect them for giving it a go, but there's also, you know, one type of consumption room is not going to necessarily give us what we want, isn't it? Because I'm assuming they're going to go with I think they're going with the most expensive model, aren't they? With medical staff on site at all times, sort of thing, where you've got. You know, you have Peter Kruijkamp did what he did in the van for a while. You know, there are different mod. You know, in an ideal world, you'd have several different types that are going on at the same time when you see if you compare and contrast sort of thing. I mean, this is baby steps, obviously, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my thinking behind it is that anything like this, we've just got to give it a go because, like you say, it could then snowball into so many other things as well. And that's why I guess I asked originally about the complex needs, is because there are certain things, mental health challenges, and sorry, multiple disadvantages, I should say, mental health, drug use have constantly been in there, but with the lack of mental health services and there's the rise of just really quite dangerous synthetic opioids as well, it just feels like now more than ever we need to take a little bit of a different approach to this. I guess the last couple of questions for me, the first one I just want to ask is around just your kind of working structure, because you mentioned you had a couple of admin days and a few, and as Andrew was saying, 70 odd mile round trips here and there. So how do you find that in the job that you do? How do you find that balance in terms of working from home, going out to places? How do you make that balance work for you?
I mean, like I said at the start of my reflection, I'm not the most organized of people, so my calendars can look all over the shop, really. So I quite enjoy having, you know, varied workload, shall we say, sort of thing. And you know, in regards to working from home, admin days or office days, I tend to work from home when my partner's not working from home, because there's only really one good place to work from home. So you know, if it was a week where I wasn't doing much and I was more office based, it would probably be, you know, a couple of days at home with 3 days in the office, really. And we've got a sort of in the centre of Cardiff, we've got a small office where we hot desk and, you know, little pods for calls and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I think it's just for me. I do use, you know, if it's not on my Outlook calendar, I don't know what I'm doing essentially. So I do everything goes on my Outlook calendar. So I do try. I'm trying to get better at planning in advance, and I've got this sort of I've got coordinated stuff on my calendar now. Where I launched a sort of resource last year called Pie at the Warwich, which is a sort of couple of page snapshot of where we're at the minute, and then we've got this slightly larger document with our future ambitions of like where, you know, if you when we achieve our strategic priority and you walk into a service, what would you see, feel, or hear within that service to know that we've become psychologically informed, you know, with sort of. So it's got future ambitions, and we've done those. And you know, each of the five pie areas is linked to our values under a different color. So on my calendar, I'm trying to always make sure I can, what I'm doing, I'm putting it in the one of the colors that I put, so I know that I'm working towards this idea of making the organizational pie. And if I can't fit it into one of those colors, which isn't very often, should I be doing this sort of thing, you know, looking at that type of thing. So I am trying to get a lot more organized. And but so yeah, it's really it's Outlook calendar, knowing what I'm doing, knowing where I'm going, and using that quite a lot, and the to-do function on Outlook as well. But it sort of rules my life, working life really, all that stuff does, if I'm honest with you. So yeah.
But when you said if it's not my calendar, it's not happening, I'm like, what sort of maniac doesn't have that system? Honestly, if it's not written down, I'm not doing it. So you're right, I need to have it written down. So I don't think you're alone with that one at all. So I guess my last question would just be like an overall question then. So from talking about this now and maybe listening back to this before you came on, what's kind of your main sort of takeaways from that week? What was your main reflection from that week then?
Listening back to it was interesting for me, who's somebody who tries to be quite reflective, that I wasn't particularly reflective in my reflection. I was talking about what I'd done that week, but not really that much about how I felt about it. Obviously, when I was talking about the stuff in Aberystwyth, I was saying it was really good to be there and to sort of see the team and how it's evolved and that sort of feeling. So that was one of the things that did stand out to me quite a bit. And after listening to the other two guests on your podcast, I've been thinking about that a little bit more over the last couple of weeks. So I think I need to, were I to do this again, or I need to start thinking about, me and myself. I do fairly regularly do. We have a 4-day organisational induction that's run in sort of Swansea, Cardiff, North Wales, and sometimes in Mid Wales, depending on the staff. Basically every 6 weeks on a rowing rower, and I do an hour and a bit in there on Pi. And we recently rejigged it, and I've done it about 5 or 6 times now. It goes over really, really well. I get like I've had some really good engagement, and there's I sort of, because it's all about relationships, I tend to have this sort of loop where it keeps coming back to that, and I hit this point at the end where it, again, you get one of those light bulb moments. And but last week I did it in Swansea, and I'd had a couple of days of just a banging headache, and it was not that it didn't go well, but it was just apparent to me how, me and how I was feeling that day could sort of affect what I'm putting across, if you know what I mean. And not that I didn't know that before, but having had such successful ones previously, and this one just, not, again, not that it fell flat in any way, shape, or form, but it wasn't quite the same sort of thing. So I'm beginning to, I'm not, I'm both of your guests previously were talking about running marathons and all that sort of stuff. Like I do work out. I do do my Joe Wicks in the morning sometimes, or I'm going to run about 5Ks, about my limit now and again, sort of thing. So trying to make sure I get up in time to do them probably before work, so it helps set me up a bit more for the day as well. So yeah.
It's not the distance. It's not the distance. It's about getting up and doing something, isn't it?
Yeah, this is it. And I always have the best of intentions to do it, but I just never quite get up in time half the time, and then you end up rushing a 20-minute one or something like that. So yeah.
If anyone wants to find out more about what you do, or if they'd like to get in touch with you, how could they go about doing that then?
They can go on our main website, which is thewarwich.com, WALLICH. I know I don't say my L's very well. So yeah, thewarwich.com, or you can email me on anthony.vaughan. So that's Anthony with a H, ANTHOMY dot Vaughan, VAUGHAN at thewarwich.net.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony, for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
No
that's it.
problem.
So that was our guest, Anthony Vaughan. Some very interesting reflections there, David, especially generally around the desires to, simplify and streamline and make sure everything can be more understandable, more easily digestible in, I guess, a more fast-paced and dynamic working environment. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and it kind of feels like this is needed more than ever. I think it came up a few times in our conversations there about the challenges of this sector. And I think this comes up and will come up with everyone we talk to, just the very nature of the world that we are covering here. And I think when you're talking about things like budget cuts, and we're talking about increased complex needs, multiple disadvantage, as Anthony was saying, I think what we need to do in services is to keep things as simple as possible, whether that's targets, the way we operate, the way we engage, keep things as simple as we possibly can. So when that person comes in, that complexity becomes the focus. We don't spend all of our time thinking about all the millions of things that we need to do. We keep focusing it on the person. Again, something he discussed in his reflection about always bringing it back to the individual in front of us.
Absolutely right. I think the exact term I think was used in the NHS lecture from the Tuesday was treat people like human beings, which I think is the kind of perfect end point that we could have on this particular episode of the podcast. So I hope you've enjoyed it, listeners. Please share, like, subscribe, send us a message if you want to on Twitter. Still never going to call it the other name, or catch us on LinkedIn, whatever your particular platform of choice is. And then all that's left for me to say is I've been Andrew James.
I've been David Gill.
And you've been listening to Frontline.